session number 6042, reel 3.
Mr. Adams, reel 3. I suppose the fact that we came under the wing of Brigadier Duke was the greatest thing that could have happened to us in our captivity, because he was such a superb man. He'd been wounded and decorated in World War I, but he was very vast, a great disciplinarian and a taskmaster. He was also very considerate to anyone who served under him. We quickly discovered why we were down at Singapore Golf Club. The Japanese command had decided to convert Royal Singapore Golf Club and a hill by it into a gigantic shrine to their war dead. And they called it Shonan Jinja, Shonan Shrine. Shonan was the name the Japanese gave to Singapore as soon as they conquered it. They said that the name Singapore would never be used again, it would just be Shonan. In addition to that, we were also part of a huge workforce that was being collected of British and Australians, to build not only the Shonan Shrine, but also the Shonan Chureto. They were building a great obelisk on the top of Bukitima, which was the turning point of their conquest of Singapore Island. Once they'd captured Bukitima, there was no stopping them. And this huge labour force was solely devoted to building these shrines and monuments, which couldn't be termed war work, so it was quite legal work. For the first month, the Japanese in charge of us were quite diabolical chaps. They were, in fact, the 15th Independent Engineer Regiment under Colonel Yokoyama, and they had been heavily decorated in the Malayan campaign. As a by the way, I'm glad to say that most of them were slaughtered in the Kohima and Imphal battles in 1944 in Burma, but after a month they were in fact moved away to Burma. And there was a couple of 3 days' delay whilst a new unit came in, and they were the 5th Division Engineer Regiment under Colonel Tamura. And here we entered what turned out to be the best 5 or 6 months of our captivity under the Japanese. It was basically a benevolent captivity. We were not worked to death. Japanese private soldiers or corporals would come to the camps each morning, not at an unearthly hour in the morning, but the sun would be out when they arrived. They'd each pick up their contingents of labour force of 25, 50, 100, 200, 400 if it was to pull a steamroller for which there was no motive power because it had been broken. And pulling a steamroller up and down a hill is not conducive to happiness. But these particular Japanese, they were quite friendly and talkative, and the ones I was often with would share they were sorry for the prisoners, and they'd give their midday ration to the prisoners, and if they were non-smokers, they'd give their cigarettes to the prisoners. I can still remember the names of these individuals. Private Tamahiro, Private Kamimura, and Lieutenant Matsuzawa, and so on. I could name many of them. And I was trying to learn a bit of Japanese, and they were trying to learn a bit of English. Whilst we were building the shrine, we saw the great triumphal flypass of the Japanese Air Force commemorating the victory of Singapore. We counted over 300 planes fly over the Makrichi Reservoir, which is within the Royal Singapore Golf Club grounds, or was then. There were flying boats, bombers, fighters, you name it, they were all there. Later on in my life, in 1976, I was to be given photographs of the work being done on this shrine when I was visiting Japan by the members of the 5th Division Engineers. The 5th Division Engineers were not prisoner of war guard troops, they were combat troops who had in fact conducted the landings on Singapore Island 48 hours after I had landed there. On the northwest coast of the island, they'd operated the landing craft and then had landed themselves and took part in the seizure of Bukit Timah and the seizure of the golf course. And when the Japanese seized the golf course, they also seized the last reservoir, MacRitchie Reservoir, and doomed. They sealed the fate of Singapore City and Singapore Island and the troops and the civilians there. So we worked comparatively happily at Sime Road, because that's the road in which the golf course is situated, or the clubhouse is situated. And we built this shrine. And some others built bridges over the ornamental bridges, all of which I have photographs. And it would have been very nice if we could have gone on the war like that, except for the fact that we weren't helping the British war effort very much. But at least we were not helping the Japanese war effort in building a shrine to the dead. And on the Bukit Timah shrine area, they constructed a small cross to the British war dead, again, of which I have a photograph. But the Japanese High Command had other plans for us. And they were going to take us away from this semi-idyllic, but not pleasant, you'll realise that, situation, where we'd had, every 10 days we had the day off. The Japanese had the day off, we had the day off. And we constructed a race course on the site of one of these burnt-out huts. And with dice and with wooden horses, we had a race meetings and there was gambling on them. And the Japanese paid at the rate of 25 cents a day for officers, 15 cents a day for sergeants, and 10 cents a day for privates and corporals. And the Japanese used to come to these race meetings too. And the food there, looking at the later captivity, was almost paradise. I know because I was a butcher, I was once taken by a Japanese sergeant to the British coal stores, or the ex-British coal stores in Singapore, which had broken down a few days before, and there was a lot of meat going off in there. And they took me and a few of my chaps to these coal stores, and we loaded this lorry full of hindquarters of Australian beef. Unfortunately, the coal stores had broken down and it had thawed out. And I took it back to our camp in Sime Road, and it worked out that there was enough for just over a pound of beef per man. And Brigadier Duke said, right, RESC can do the job, as that was their purpose in life, or one of them. Sort it out and issue all the units with enough for £1 a man. And I said, Brigadier, this meat will make everyone sick. He said, how do you know? I said, because I've smelt it and I've tasted a little bit of the raw meat, just a fraction on my tongue. He said, oh, everyone needs meat. Issue it. So he ordered one of the doctors to inspect it, and the doctor said, well, it isn't very fresh, but in view of our lack of meat, we'll issue it. So I said, well, I can be as hungry as I like, but I'm not touching that meat. So two or three of my friends said, well, if he ain't touching it, I'm not touching it. The following day, by the way, just over 98% of the camp were incapable of doing anything through having acute diarrhoea. But I was all right because I hadn't touched this meat. That was to recur 2 years later in Japan, a similar situation. So I wasn't sorry that I had foregone my £1 of steak on this occasion. But the life wasn't bad there. Now, officers had to go out to supervise working parties, but there were sufficient officers that only junior officers were used. Captains and above didn't go out to work. They did work in the camp, like administration and things. But I was a subaltern, so I went out. And sometimes I went out every day, sometimes I went out every other day. And sometimes these particular Japanese, if they were going into Singapore City to fetch something, they'd say, just 10 men want to come and see Singapore. And in fact, my first sight of Singapore City was from the back of a Japanese army lorry. where I also had my first sight of the famous Raffles Hotel. With 10 men, I was taken into Singapore, ostensibly to go and fetch some wood for the shrine. But the Japanese dropped us off at a Chinese cafe, and they paid for a cup of coffee for each of us at this cafe. And they disappeared and said we were not to go anywhere, which, of course, there was nowhere to go to when we were given a coffee. And once the Japanese had gone, the Chinese also gave us all sorts of biscuits and sweetmeats. And the Japanese were away for about 2 hours, and they'd been to a brothel. And then when they got into the lorry, we picked up a few pieces of wood, and we went back to the shrine. And there were lots of little incidents like that. But the word came, the Japanese troops were going to be sent elsewhere. Post-war, I discovered they were sent to the Solomon Islands, and you know what happened in the Solomon Islands with the American invasion of the Solomons. And the High Command had other plans for most of the prisoners that were available to them. That, of course, was to build the railway to connect Thailand to Burma, to link Rangoon and Moh Mein with Bangkok and Singapore by rail. And we were part of that task force. So our Japanese left us, and prior to leaving us, they'd handed us over to some diabolical guards, Koreans, their first sight of Koreans, and Sikhs. That's Sikhs of the British Army or British police in Singapore, who had turncoated, I might say, under great duress in many cases. And they, in fact, were the worst guards we ever had with the Sikhs. But they were a great minority of the very brave Sikhs who fought with the British Army. But it is recordable that they were bastards to us, as were the Koreans, as very often were the Japanese. But the Japanese we'd had in that particular Sime Road shrine camp were not bad at all. So much so that I've visited them twice since the war. And the orders came for us to march down to Singapore's splendid railway station, which we did, quite a long way, carrying all our pots and pans with us. And we arrived there in the late afternoon and were very depressed at seeing that our we didn't know where we were going to at this stage, of course. We didn't know how long the journey was. And the trucks were already in the station. There were 600 of us. The trucks were already in the station. 30 trucks, steel, what we called rice trucks, not cattle trucks, as I've frequently heard said. And so it was a simple matter of 600 into 30. The Japanese guards took a couple of the trucks for themselves. One truck was used for heavier type baggage, and I finished up in a truck with a lot of other officers, and there were 28 of us in this truck, which had a capacity of cargo of 10 tons. There was not, of course, room enough to lie down, and people used to stand up, sit down, kneel down, lean against each other for the journey, which turned out to be a journey of 5 days and 4 nights. And if you look at it on the map, it covers about 1,000 miles from Singapore to a small town in Thailand called Banpong. It was a most miserable journey. The only relieving fact of it was that from twice a day we stopped, and Japanese army units put a bit of food aboard, and the food wasn't too bad. As to water, we had to rely on the kindness of the engine driver, who was a Sikh. A lot of Sikhs worked on Malayan state railways pre-war and during the war. And whenever the train stopped, which it frequently did, to allow other trains to pass it on sidings, we went to him and he would let us have water out of the locomotive. In fact, I and quite a few of my friends, every morning, if the train made a stop, we would get enough hot water out of the locomotive to shave. Because most of the time I was a prisoner, I was determined to keep shaved and respectable. The most awful thing of the journey was that a lot of us had diarrhoea and or dysentery, and the question again of defecation. And to defecate with a train going, say, at 15 or 20 miles an hour, with your friends holding your feet and holding your hands while you lean out of the train, is not a very enthralling experience. And you normally had to post someone looking ahead to see if you were coming to a bridge, most of which were made by Dorman Long, we noticed, because if your backside was hanging out, it could well catch the bridge and put paid to you. But even horrible things can come to an end, and we finally landed at Ban Pong, a station on the Singapore-Bangkok railway, and the base of what was to become the Thailand-Burma Railway. We went into a most diabolical POW camp, which was in fact a transit camp. The entire camp was underwater. The trench latrines had long disappeared, and their contents were floating freely through the camp, through the little huts, which were in a state of complete collapse. And we stayed there for two nights of utter and complete misery. Having been a student of history pre-war, particularly of the Great War on the Western Front, it was my first sort of real taking me back into what condition in the trenches of the 1418 war must have been like, when they were flooded, for instance, in the Battle for Passchendaele and other places in Flanders and Artois in France. But it was quite diabolical. And the POWs running this camp really were a lot of vampires. People who suffered for 5 days and were at their wit's end to know how to exist, because 5 days basically without sleep doesn't improve you. They were there to buy anything that was offered, watches, fountain pens, clothing, and they were rather a despicable lot. From there we went on a march for approximately 52 kilometres, and I wound up at Tamarkan, which has become very famous since the war, because when Pierre Boulle wrote his book about the River Kwai, the bridge on the River Kwai, it was obvious that part of the story, which is pure fiction, of course, was based on the existence of the massive steel bridge which we built over the river at Tamarkan. Not, I might add, over the River Kwai, but over the main river, the Mekong, of which the Kwai is a tributary, and loses its identity there when it enters the River Mekong. That camp, by later Thailand standards, was not bad. Once the original Japanese commandant had gone, he wasn't there for very long, Lieutenant Kokuba, who firmly believed that in work allocation, the formula was one elephant does the work of 8 officers who do the work of 14 other ranks. He explained that he had his formula by the fact that he'd seen some statistics about the British Army which said that officers were taller and heavier than other ranks. However, his successor was much better and basically left the running of the camp to a British colonel and a British captain in the Argylls, who now in his retirement is in command of a disabled serviceman's hospital in Scotland, in Erskine, the Princess Louise Hospital. Now Colonel Boyle, he was then Captain David Boyle. So it was a case of basically live and let live at Tamarkan. We erected the two bridges there, the steel bridge, which came from the East Indies in sections. In fact, the Japanese had stolen it from the Dutch. But as they conquered the East Indies, they probably didn't think it was stealing. and a wooden bridge just downstream of the steel bridge, a wooden bridge with which to act as an emergency bridge, but also to get the railway line across, pending the completion of the steel bridge. We completed the wooden bridge by February 1943, and the railway went through, and we completed the steel bridge by May 1943, and then the railway could travel either by wooden bridge or steel bridge. I have many photographs of this particular area, both of Japanese source, RAF sources, US Air Force sources, and post-war sources right up to 1981. Once the bridge was finished, the camp at Tamarkan, which was called by many a cushy camp, and certainly it was the best camp I was in Thailand, best as that was for food and living conditions. We were divided into two halves. Half stayed at Tamarkan and the other half went what was called upcountry on an unknown march to an unknown destination. By which time the monsoon had broken and there was pouring rain all the time, and we set off and via a variety of POW camps scattered along the railway line or the trace where the railway line was to go, we finished up at the worst camp I was in Thailand, Khin Saeok. Really, a better name for it would have been a swamp, because this camp, because of the intensity of the monsoon and because the Japanese had located it on the banks of the river Kwai Noi, and the camp occupied a little hollow or a little basin. The high point of the basin was occupied by the Japanese guards and commander, and the low point was occupied by the prisoners' huts, which were very mean and squalid things in a state of semi-collapse. Other prisoners had been here before us, and most of them, but not all, had been evacuated sick to the base areas. And here began some very hard work for all the prisoners. It was compounded by the fact that shortly after we got there, cholera appeared. First in the coolies, that was Asiatic coolies who'd been conscripted by the Japanese to assist in the construction of the railway, but also quickly picked up by prisoners, because the coolies had a habit of not getting rid of their cholera dead by burning. And also they, of course, lacked army or navy or air force discipline, which the prisoners had to some degree. And they would throw the bodies into the river. And cholera, as you may know, is a waterborne disease, quickly spreadable. During the time we were there, of the 900, 300 either died or had to be evacuated to the base area by one method or another. And the Japanese there showed not the slightest modicum of humanity. One or two individual Japanese showed it, but generally it was an absolute hell. The place smelt so heavily, the Japanese would not issue chloride of lime for sanitary purposes. We were short of wood. We could not drink safely any water, although we were surrounded by it, unless that water had been boiled. So surrounded by water, we were rather like shipwrecked sailors. Water, water everywhere, and not a drop to drink. The food ration in this camp was the worst we had in Thailand. The morning meal, which was eaten before dawn, was sloppy rice. That's rice cooked to look like porridge, with no flavouring, no salt, no sugar, just sloppy rice, which we call pap. The midday meal, if it was available, was a small portion of dry rice, that's cooked but dry, with a watery vegetable soup with very few solids in it. And the evening meal was a repetition of the lunch. On some occasions, in the main work at Khin Saeok, which was the preparation of a massive cutting through solid rock. Sometimes, if the Japanese taskmasters, that's the Japanese 9th Railway Regiment, if they wanted to continue and complete a particular piece, they would keep the prisoners out for up to 48 hours continuously. Sick men from the camp having to take out some food for them, and the work would be done by the light of petrol-powered arc lights. A quite diabolical place. And many of the prisoners working on this cutting with all these sharp rocks had no shoes, so feet were in a most awful condition. Most of the prisoners were just by this time wearing just a G-string, or what the Japanese call a fundoshi, and were in the most appalling, emaciated condition. Every morning there was a terrible fight with the Japanese command, whilst Captain Janis, who had learned a lot of Japanese, with two or three of our doctors, that is, Allied doctors, would have a great battle with the Japanese about who was sick and who was not. The Japanese said that they did not allow more than 5% of the camp strength to be sick. Of course, unfortunately, the actual true picture would be that about 75% of the camp were sick, but the situation was that only 5% of them could stay in camp. One was more likely to be allowed to stay in camp if one had something awful to show, like a huge ulcer on the leg or the arm, than if one's stomach or innards were being torn apart by a variety of worms, dysenteries of two varieties, or one was severely stricken with malaria in one of its varieties. However, for half of my own time in Kinsayok, and that's what you've asked me to talk about, I was suddenly detached to a Japanese repair workshop for vehicles. When the Japanese overran the Far East, they captured many fine motor vehicles from the Americans, British, Australians and Dutch. And they brought a lot of the American vehicles to Thailand and a lot of the British ones. And because of the atrocious track that led to Kinsayo, those that they tried to get supplies through had broken down with broken springs and all manner of damage to them.